You're tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. This morning we are bringing you a very special broadcast, a panel discussion, Violence, Fear, and the Refugee Crisis, Faithful Insights. This is a panel that was recorded on March 31st at Rockhurst University in the Greenlease Library, Finucane Jesuit Center. In this program, we will hear faith leaders share wisdom from their faith traditions about how to respond to violence, fears, and the refugee crisis. Should our responses be grounded in moral, faith-based values? Do we need to respond to violence with more violence? This program was sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee, the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council, and Rockhurst University Voices for Justice.
I'm Bill Creagy. I'm a campus minister here at Rockhurst. I'm the faculty staff advisor for Voices for Justice. It's a student organization here on campus. This is their traditional Thursday night meeting. Voices for Justice is pairing up with SEEK, which is our interfaith organization on campus, to bring this event. We're really grateful, Ira, for reaching out to us and for bringing a host of So I'm not going to speak anymore. I'm going to turn it over to Ira and take it away. But again, thank you so much to you and for all of you for being here. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Bill, and thanks to Voices and to SEEK for inviting us to come here on campus. My name's Ira Harrett. I'm the program coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker-based peace and social justice organization. So we've kind of reached out to the council and to Bill because we're concerned. And I think you all are here because you have some concerns about what's happening in Syria and the Middle East, how that's impacting families that are fleeing violence, and how the reaction that has greeted them has not been very compassionate at times. And so the American Friends Service Committee wants to help our community take a deeper look about what are the real fears that exist, what are the real causes of the refugee crisis, and what are the best ways that we can respond. Before I go any further, I do first want to acknowledge that this event is co-sponsored by the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council. And the council's purpose, for those that don't know, is to grow a sustainable, pervasive culture of knowledge, respect, appreciation, and trust among all faiths and religious traditions in the Greater Kansas City community. And so there's several members of the council here, in addition to several of our speakers. But Sheila, would you like to just say hello?
Hello.
And then we also have Geneva Blackmere, who's back there, who's an intern working with the council this year. And then I'm wearing two hats. So I'm program coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee, but I'm also the Sufi faith director on the council. So I, am pleased to be able to help organize this event to further our interfaith interests and goals, but also for the goals that the American Friends Service Committee has. And before we just move right into a hearing from our faith leaders, I want to share something that I learned from a talk by Lieutenant Colonel Brian Steed, who is a military history instructor at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College in Leavenworth. He's given a number of programs in the community, but one of the key things that he has brought up in those programs is that the conflict with Daesh or ISIS or the so-called self-proclaimed Islamic State is a battle that will not be won primarily by military means, but rather that it will be won by control of the narrative. Okay, the narrative. The narrative that will win the hearts and minds of the people in the Middle East, in Syria, in Iraq, and maybe also the world. And so with that in mind, I raise this question for you to think about as we hear our speakers, and that is, are our actions consistent with deep faith values? If we make our actions more consistent with these values, will we be more likely to win that battle over the narrative? Okay? So, with that, I will introduce all the speakers right now, and then one by one they'll come up. So from my right Dr. Anton Jacob. He is a retired UCC United
Church of Christ.
Church of Christ, thank you, sorry. Clergyman. He received his Master of Divinity from Eden Theological Seminary and a PhD from the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Religion and the Critical Mind and is Christian and is the Christian Protestant Faith Director of the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council. Next to him is Zora Husani, who was born and raised in Kansas City, but her family immigrated here from Afghanistan in the early 80s. She works as a nurse practitioner at KU and is in the EMBA program here at Rockhurst and is a devout Muslim. And next in line is Baswati Ray, who is a software engineer, but her real passion is to serve humanity. She does this through her work with the United Nations Association, the Greater Kansas City chapter, and actually just returned from a women's conference at the UN in New York City, Women Intercultural Network, the Kansas City Bengali Association, and is the Greater Kansas City, he's one of the Greater Kansas City Council at Large directors, and she's of the Hindu faith. And then finally, Alan Edelman is Associate Executive Director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Kansas City. He has a master's degree in Jewish education from the Jewish Theological Seminary and is the Jewish Faith Director of the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council. So, Anton, would you like to begin?
All right. We were told to make this very short, so this is, I'll keep it under 45 minutes. I'm representing Protestant Christianity. Of course, the problem here is there isn't the Protestant Christianity. There are many Protestant Christianities. But just to let you know who I am specifically in some broad sense, I'm a liberal Protestant who happens to also have very progressive political views. But insofar as I can, I want to state what I perceive to be the modal attitudes of Protestantism while acknowledging some of the differences found in Protestant thought. Now, I'm not talking so much about what Protestants do, but what they believe. And this is a distillation, I suppose, in a sense of its best thinkers, its leading thinkers, its theologians, its major periodicals. So, and of course, in the world of everyday life, Protestant Christians are not just Protestants, right? They are also people of different genders and races and nationalities and ethnicities, as well as diverse philosophical views. So there is a great deal of variation. But I want to state several core points, reflecting on the three major concepts in the theme tonight. And then I hope we'll have some time to elaborate more on some of the complexities. The dominant position in Protestant thinking about refugees, extreme violence, and fear are these, I would argue. Refugees are to be received with graciousness and generosity, with gracious hospitality. Secondly, extreme violence should not be responded to with extreme violence. Third point that I would argue is leading Protestant thought. The issue of refugees and terrorism should not be linked, as it's being linked in the current political culture. And the fourth, I would say, is that fear should not be the driving force in our relation to the world and to the neighbor. Now, I would say this, since we don't have any Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox representatives speaking tonight, that what I'm saying, I think, generally agrees also with those faith traditions as well. But I'm not speaking for them, but I think that that's true enough. The first thing I want to say is that the modal theological notion, abstractly speaking, regarding refugees for Protestants comes from the Bible. You know, Protestants are Bible thumpers. They really like to pull out the Bible texts. Now, I'm talking about the Hebrew Scriptures, the Christian New Testament. The dominant view, fairly consistent throughout the biblical text, is one of gracious hospitality to strangers and sojourners. Now, you can find some minor voices that warn against fellowship with unbelievers and even paint a particularly harmful view here and there about those outside the Christian fold, especially in some of the later New Testament texts. But these minor voices don't overshadow, it seems to me, the overwhelming attitude that people in need, and certainly those seeking refuge, i.e. refugees, are to be welcomed and hosted with care and generosity. That is the starting point for thoughtful Protestants, because that is what they read the Bible as teaching. Now, there are practical problems in the world, of course, that introduce fear and insecurity, national economies, budgets, and nationalist sentiments, and other things. But the first question for Protestant thought regarding refugees, I would argue, no matter where they come from, the refugees, no matter where they come from, or what their religion is, what do they need and how can we help? That's the first thing. Now, there is a difference in approach to refugees, you'll notice, among Protestants. If you study what they're doing in the world with regard to refugees, there's a wide continuum in Protestantism, the conservatives on one end and liberals on the other, and there's a tendency for conservative Protestants to view refugees not only as people to be loved and cared for, but also as people to be, simply converted. They view the reception and hospitality of refugees often as an opportunity to witness to Jesus Christ. That's in the literature. You can find it. It's readily available. But whereas typically the moderate to liberal Protestants don't view the reception and the hospitality to refugees as an opportunity to win hearts and minds to Jesus. Now, regarding the response to extremist violence, the modal Protestant view is that extremist violence is a matter of military defense and civilian law enforcement. It should not be linked to the refugee issue. Doesn't matter whether you're reading the conservative journal, Christianity Today, or the liberal, the Christian Century, the dominant voice among leading Protestant thinkers rejects the idea that refugees should be seen, first of all, as potential terrorists. Now, Protestant attitudes regarding reactions to extremist violence are predominantly those, I would say, of just war and just defense notions, the rule of law, non-aggression, proper and measured defense. You don't target non-combatants, you don't torture, and you treat prisoners humanely and so on. Some of you know about those things. Now, of course, I can find on one end of the continuum of Protestantism those who argue for a very pacifist approach to violence, no matter what kind of violence it is. We have what's called the left-wing Protestantism with regard to pacifism. But on the other end, there are those who argue for more militaristic, and you'll even hear voices sometimes argue for what most of us would consider cruel and inhumane methods of response. The dominant Protestant view, though, is one of what I would call, with regard to the extremist violence we're seeing and experiencing, I would call it love's agony. Love's agony. That is the most difficult challenge of articulating and practicing humane and compassionate responses, even to enemies, while still preserving the peace and the security of human communities. And that's what Love's Agony is all about as we try to live out a faith in a compassionate faith in a complicated and violent world. That last concept, fear, just a few comments here. The Protestant, this is really the Christian view, is that fear should not be our primary motivation. Fear should not motivate us. Love, compassion, graciousness, they're first of all the values for Christian thought regarding our relations to others. Fear not is a consistent biblical theme, and it's supported by the idea that one's fundamental orientation to God and to the universe and to others is trust and love, which remove fear. Doesn't mean we're to throw caution to the wind and live in ways that are reckless for us and others, but that our core motive in life and for the neighbor can't be fear. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for having me be a part of this panel. I wish I could say that I've written a book or that I've held some high position somewhere or I've done much of these types of topic panel type discussions. So I feel like it's kind of an honor actually for me to be able to stand before you as a normal, everyday practicing Muslim who can just be out there to kind of just show the perspective of a non-scholarly person. And I do say that with a little intent because there might be some questions that are asked of me, which I don't have the knowledge of regarding maybe Islamic law or jurisprudence. And I might defer some questions because of that. However, I think it's definitely a very good and important topic to discuss, especially with all the events going on in the world today, representing and misrepresenting Islam. I'd like to open with a simple quote from the Quran that states, "Invite people to the way of your Lord with kind words and use the most sound logic in your presentation." So essentially, anytime we have a position where we believe something different, where we have a different understanding of any topic, where we have a conflict with someone in regards to belief or any kind of disagreement, Islam teaches us not to go combatantly towards resolving that problem with somebody, but instead using kind of a very peaceful approach to resolve the issue and also bringing this topic of sound logic. So presenting facts and proofs to help clarify or defend your presence in that position. Over kind of a general understanding of Islam, I'd just like to bring out a few points, and then this kind of helps to define some of the topics that they've asked us to discuss today and what that means related to those topics. So Islam is really, it comes from a root word meaning that comes from salam, meaning peace. So it's sometimes ironic that we have to have this discussion about a religion that stems from a root word of peace to then have to prove or denounce that it would denounce terrorism. And so that kind of seems a little ironic to me, but hopefully we can bring some understanding to that. And another misconception, we use the word Allah, which is a term or a characteristic that defines God. So it's an absolute creator, one God that we believe in, and just as Christians would use the term the Father, or if it's in Judaism, they'll use the term Elohim to describe the one God. So it's a monotheistic faith, and I think sometimes people seem to kind of misconstrue that word that's being used. But he's an absolute creator, and he has created a universal system that we all, you know, are prescribed to follow. So it's really a way of life. And every religion is truly a way of life, even whether we say that we don't believe in a religion or we don't believe in a God. That's a person's way of their life. That's how they choose to live. And so with an absolute creator creating this universal system, there's absolute good that Islam, at least the perspective of Islam, believes. And with that, with this notion of absolute good, evil really only exists if we deviate from that which God prescribes for us. So it's just the opposite of good. So we've all been created, essentially, this topic of how Islam prescribes this religion for us, this way of life for us. We've all been created to submit to God. So not necessarily the submission because God needs us to submit to him, but to create a universal peace and harmony within humanity. So he doesn't need us for him, he needs us to submit for the sake of having peace within the community and among those that live with us. And there's various verses that explain that we are created differently for reasons. So it's not to say that only Muslims should be, giving, you know, each other peace and harmony and submitting for that purpose, but all of humanity. So it's not selective to just one group or one community or faith. So we've all been created and we've all got a right and due justice. Not, again, just me or just Muslims, but all people have a right and due justice, and we're given this freedom. And it's been clearly stated that nobody is allowed to take that freedom from you, either by force or by any means, without your own desire or will to believe or to follow any other form of religion or belief that you choose not to. So this freedom of will is prescribed to us all, and there is no one person or entity or group that can forcefully take this from you. So we talk about this notion of terrorism. So terrorism definitively is to take away that freedom, inflict some harm, some fear into the hearts of people, or to terrorize them, essentially. So I think it's a little bit ironic, I guess I should say again, to define Islam, this religion that stems from a root word of peace, and then directly have a connection or association where most people recognize it as a terrorism or a terrorist religion. And I think a lot of this comes from, of course, the events that we've seen going on around the world, and 9/11 being kind of a core example where that association has been made. Truly, however, based on the teachings that I grew up learning and most Muslims, mainstream Muslims believe, Islam really condemns those acts of 9/11. And what we can kind of use to help realize that, there's another verse in the Quran that I would like to quote, which is, if you kill even one human, it's as if you've killed all of humanity, and if you save even one person or one human, it's as if you've saved a whole nation or all of humanity. So how, you know, you look at this and say, well, how can a religion that promotes this absolute creator who creates or who is absolutely good at the same time go and prescribe people to commit such acts of hate or acts of, you know, violence such as killing or, you know, all the things that we've seen going on? To kind of put some things into perspective, statistically, there's, I'd say, roughly 2 billion Muslims in the world who practice the religion. It's the fastest growing religion in the world. I think today, if we look at the statistics, 6.5 billion, maybe close to 7 billion people on Earth. So when we look at the numbers, it's a pretty large quantity. Third almost of the earth, of people on the earth that practice this faith. So it's kind of, you know, interesting that if this faith truly is prescribing or telling people to commit such acts, or if there's such clear verbiage to say, go out and do this terrorism act, it's just a large number of people. I mean, it's an assumption that we can make that we're all, you know, insane masochists who choose to go this path of this evil. But, you know, I think most people are repulsed by that. So if you were to open a book and you read this notion of kill or do this or, you know, by fear or by power enforce these laws, we would mostly be pretty repulsed by that. And it was just an interesting fact. I think I had read an article in the New York Times which indicated that after 9/11, there was actually a quadrupled number of people who converted to Islam. So again, it just makes me wonder if this was truly what was being taught, why such a vast number of individuals who were being drawn to this religion. So again, we go back to kind of this notion that Islam does not teach this violence. Truly, there's a right upon all of us that we have that nobody can take from us. And I'll just recite one more verse from the Quran that mentions, no repulsion, no compulsion in religion. Truth is clear from error, and mankind has been endowed with free will. Every mankind, so all people, have been endowed with this free will. Let them accept what they want and reject what they want. The choice is theirs, as long as they are alive and they have full control of their destiny. So again, it's not in any way explaining that people have the right to, by fear or by terror, convert someone or force them to believe in something. So really, a God who creates, you know, this free will would never send prophets or people to us to then take that free will from us. And really, there's just this simply going back to kind of the tenets of what we're trying to discuss here in a summary. I think it's pretty clear that mainstream Islam, truly the idea is that we reject such acts and this terrorism, especially trying to impose something by fear upon people, and it's definitely not something that's within the teachings of true Islam. So those of us who've actually opened a Quran and read it for the context of which it's in, we do understand that this is not what it's teaching. So a lot of what the media is showing is obviously not highlighting those factors, and so we see a lot of the misconceptions that are being presented. But it's really, you know, this way of life is for us to accept and for us to be judged by the one creator, not by others, and not for others to then impose what their beliefs are to then be upon us as well. There's obviously a lot more depth that we could go in, and I would also like to keep it brief. And there's some topics with regards to the actual refugee crisis, which I have some personal, obviously, experience with my family being a refugee family. And so those obviously would be open to discussion as well, and I'd be happy to talk about that too later. Thank you.
We are listening to an interfaith panel recorded on March 31st at Rockhurst University, entitled Violence, Fear, and the Refugee Crisis, Faithful Insights. The last speaker we heard was Zohra Husseini, a devout Muslim, a nurse practitioner, whose family immigrated from Afghanistan in the early 80s. The next speaker we will hear will be Baswati Ray, a Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council at-large director of the Hinduism faith. But first, here's the American Friends Service Committee's Ira Harrett on a similar event coming up.
Well, the American Friends Service Committee's next program addressing the topics of Syrian refugee crisis and responding to extremist violence will be on May 19th. That's a Thursday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. The program is entitled Confronting Extremist Violence, the Refugee Crisis and Fear, Faith Responses. And this will be taking place at the Kansas City, Missouri Plaza Branch at 4801 Main Street. We're really excited to have a great panel, including Dr. Vernon Howard, who's the president of the SCLC of Greater Kansas City, Fadi Banamare, Syrian-born and a board member of the Islamic Society of Greater Kansas City, and Rabbi Linda Steigman, who's on the board of the Rabbinical Association in Greater Kansas City, and Father Paul Turner, who is pastor of St. Anthony Parish and is Roman Catholic Bishop Johnston's ecumenical representative. In addition to these great speakers, we'll also have, preceding the panel, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Steed, who teaches at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, to provide a strategic context for the program. And it will be moderated by Bill Timaeus, who's a retired KC Star columnist and the author of Faith Matters blog. That's all at the Kansas City Public Library on May 19th, Thursday at 6:30 to 8, and preceded by a reception. And we encourage people to RSVP on the library website.
Back after these messages.
We hope this next event on May 19th will help our community recognize that we will not improve our security at home nor defeat extremism abroad by fear-driven Islamophobia, xenophobia, and vengeful military actions. Instead, hope for the future will come through the rejection of fear and looking to the core values taught by all faiths: compassion, love, respect, and truth. Security and peace and the defeat of extremism will come not from weapons and bombs, but from actions that win the hearts and minds of the world.
And again, that was the American Friends Service Committee's Ira Harrett speaking about the next event coming up on May 19th. Now let's go back to March 31st, Rockhurst University, and Basrati Ray.
Namaskar. I think many of you know the meaning of this. It means the divinity within me. It calls Atman, the unit of Brahman, the Godhead, is greeting the divinity within you. Hinduism is one of the oldest religion of the world, you know that. There are historical evidence of 5,500 to 6,000 years old early Harappan period or Indus Valley civilization. But Hinduism started much earlier than those period. Its roots goes back to a prehistoric period. Obviously, Hinduism has gone through never-ending series of changes, still it's going. Big temples, idols, festivals, etc. came in much later time. But core spirituality, philosophy of the Vedas and Upanishads, these are the scriptures of Hinduism, of ancient India, composed by philosophers, poets, seers, seekers of they called rishis. They were seeking the connection between us and the universe and seeking the absolute truth, the indivisible, infinite reality, what's going on between me and the whole universe, things like that. Those concepts has not changed. The geographical and cultural diversity in India is very high. In spite of this, the main sentiment, the values or the ideals or beliefs are the same all throughout the subcontinent of India. But later on, it branched out, the Sikhism, Buddhism, Jainism, all are the branches of Hinduism, originally Hindu. So I will go to the root, ancient scriptures. They were not written until a later time. They were orally memorized generations after generations. So all their Sanskrit hymns, verses, So I picked three verses to address the main topics today, and I will read translation of those, and will read a few lines from the original Sanskrit transcript. You will hear a lot of Shanti mantras whenever you go to a temple in Sanskrit mantras. Shanti means peace. And a Shanti mantra from Brihadaranyak Upanishad. Upanishad is the oldest scripture. And then you'll see these mantras pray for humans, not Indians or Hindus. Now, even for domestic animals, birds and forests and sky and rivers and oceans. And living and all non-living objects too. So it's about universe. All religion in the world seeks for the betterment of mankind, of environment, of society. If a religion suggests violence against violence, then by definition it's not a religion. It's something else, right? Now the Shanti mantra that I will utter, Madhu Vataritayate Madhush Karanti Sindhava, it goes like that. And none of us here understand Sanskrit, I guess. I will read the translation. In Rabindranath Tagore, he got Nobel Literature Prize from Asia, the first man to get that. He was from Bengal, and in Bengali he writes, Edulok Modhumoy Epritivir Thuli. You heard Modhu, the word repeatedly. Modhu, the direct translation of the word Modhu is honey. But in translation, it says sweetness. Because honey here doesn't mean exactly the beer bottle you buy from the store. But honey means, the bliss. The peacefulness, or how I say this, the pleasantness, like sweetness of honey. It's the extract or the essence of the core nectar of everything. That's how it goes. Let the sweetness of honey shower on you. Let the rivers yield honey. Let plants and herbs be wrapped with sweetness. Let the night and day become sweet. Let the earth and humanity be sweet. Let our ancestors, the heaven, the earth be sweet. Let the vegetation be covered with sweetness. Let the sun be sweet and our cows give sweet milk. Here, ancient Indians were very much dependent on cattle, so you see that in the hand, in this Sanskrit hand. India was invaded many times in history, Mughal, British, etc. And since British left India 69 years ago, the border remains open in many places, and, continuous influx of refugees is a crisis, but India never, deported or driven away or, did this to refugees at all. The verse that I'm going to recite is from Taittiriya Upanishad, and old scripture. Matri Deva Bhava, Pitri Deva Bhava, Acharya Deva Bhava, Atithi Deva Bhava. And it translates to, be one for whom the mother is God. Be one for whom the father is God. Be one for whom the teacher is God. And be one for whom the guest is God. It is very clear, of course they are not gods. It is advising to respect your mother, your father, your teachers, and your guests. Now, the thing that I'd like to say, what the guests mean. Atithi is a word that cannot be translated in English. So it translated as guests. So now I will explain what guests mean. Who are these guests? Who is not expected? Who is not invited or invited formally? Atithi, tithi means a particular point in time. There's nothing like that. So that means whose date of arrival or departure are not fixed may arrive anytime. So that means that anyone may arrive anytime to your door. That those people are referred as guests here. So see, and you know, you as you respect your father and mother and teachers who are giving to you, someone arrived to your door and you give whatever you have to your guest. No distinction should be made based on guest color, caste, or creed. One should accommodate their wish and welcome with warmth and love and shower with caring and affection. All religions seek for the betterment of environment, individuals, scientists, right? But some religion focuses more on one area than the other. Like American Indian spirituality focuses more on environmental harmony. Christianity and Islam focuses on society. Hinduism focuses more on individual spirituality. So now I will recite one that explains about fear. How we should strengthen our inner power. I don't know how to explain this. Rabindranath Tagore, I will recite from, his poem is not from the ancient script, but he was very much influenced by Upanishad. So in his poem, you will hear the resonance of ancient scriptures. In this poem, he is saying that I pray to God to give me the strength, inner strength, so in good times, so that in bad times I'm not confused or I don't question your existence. Save me from danger is not my prayer. In face of danger, may I not fear. To my pained heart, consolation you may not offer. Instead, sorrows may I be able to conquer. If help I cannot gather, my strength not shatter. If loss I bear, if deception is all that I could gather, may I not accept defeat ever. Please deliver may not be my prayer. To stay afloat, may I have the power. Your burden I will shoulder. Such consolation you may not offer. May I always have the power to bear. In days of joys to you, humbly my prayer may I be able to offer. In nights of despair, when deceives the world entire, may I not doubt you ever. Namaskar.
Critics of religion often argue that the monotheistic religions are inherently violent. Jack Nelson Palmyre writes, "Judaism, Christianity, and Islam will continue to contribute to the destruction of the world until and unless each challenges violence in sacred texts, and until each affirms the nonviolent power of God. And I think this is really the essence of what the monotheistic religion, certainly for the last 4,000 years, have done to either conquest of land or forced conversion or perpetuate their faith as the only faith. And I think the monotheistic religious traditions need to own that and need to recognize that our texts, as you've heard from the other speakers, our texts contain lots more literature, wisdom literature, related to peace and why we should respect each other than the violent aspects. So we have to ask ourselves, why is it that the violence, you know, it's kind of like the evening news, it's much more interesting, or the news in general, much more interesting to hear about violent things than about the good things in the world. And gatherings like this, and I applaud the students for having an interest in this, because the future is clearly in your hands. We haven't done such a great job. And so hopefully we'll see a different direction with your generation. And Judaism certainly teaches so much about nonviolence. The fact that from the very beginning of the book of Genesis, we're all created in the image of God. And it was wonderful to hear the quote from the Quran, which is also in the Talmud, that when one destroys a single individual, it's like destroying the entire world. So here are two traditions that over history and in recent times are in conflict, yet both of our sacred texts say the same thing. Our text in the Torah, which is the blueprint of Jewish life, the five books of Moses, the first five books, actually legislates that when the Israelites go to take the land after experiencing their 400 years of slavery in Egypt, there are ways that you behave even in war, which may sound a little incongruous, but there's very, very specific commandments that you first try and make peace. When you approach a city to do battle with it, you shall first call it to peace. And if they respond in peace, and they open the city to you, all the people in the city shall be part of your community. And I'm going to talk about the stranger pretty soon. And if they do not make peace, then you may besiege them. But you cannot do anything to create a situation whereby people are starving to death. You've got to respect the human dignity of the people. And again, it doesn't seem to make sense, but in the context of the Hebrew Bible, and we have to understand it in the context of the time. But you're not even able to, you're not allowed to destroy fruit trees. When it war against the city, you have to besiege it a long time. You must not destroy its trees, wielding an axe against them. Anything, because that provides food and nourishment. And we might take that for granted today, but in ancient times, every single tree, every single piece of fruit was so precious that this commandment not to destroy it. And the sensitivity to life. And for the Jewish tradition, these were issues that we dealt with in biblical times, but for the last 2,000 years, we ourselves have been strangers in many, many strange lands, have dealt with a great deal of persecution, much of it from other religious traditions that led to things like, when we think about the Crusades or the Spanish Inquisition or even the Holocaust, so much of that was perpetuated simply because, we were Jews. But since 1948, we are back in our homeland, in the land of Israel. We have an army once again for the first time in 2,000 years. So we're facing these challenges once again. How do you have a moral army? How do you defend yourself and not be aggressors? It creates a lot of challenges, and there's a lot of discussion within Israel and for Jews around the world about how Israel has to behave and deal with whether it's terrorism or the many wars that it's been engaged in. But there's much discussion about that, and that discussion is very, very important and should not come from a religious context as opposed to political context. So it's complicated, but again, as I said, I think we have to own this extremism, which over the centuries, each of our faiths have perpetuated one way or another. Regarding the stranger, and again, we shared the same tradition, and Donna beat me too. You took my biblical text, but we share that biblical text, and it's wonderful that in the book of Exodus, you shall not oppress the stranger, for you know the feeling of being a stranger, having been strangers in the land of Egypt. And the rabbis, you know, further extrapolated that you shall not wrong or oppress a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And 24 times in the five books of Moses, and in every case, the Torah lays down laws concerning the rights of people and even items, things in this strange land. And the sensitivity that we have to have, especially, and if anybody should understand that after 2,000 years, certainly the Jewish people do. But even before that, and we've always been a people of journeying and stranging, strangers. Abraham himself left Ur in what today is Iraq, and was commanded to leave and be a stranger and go to a strange land. So we from our very, very beginning, and in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is the paradigmatic evil society, our tradition teaches that the sin was how they treated the strangers. And you might remember from the story that strangers indeed come in, and the men in that town want to do things not appropriate or appreciated by those strangers. So that's how much of an emphasis there is on how we treat the strangers, the stranger in our midst. And even our own experience in this country, and we're dealing now with the issue of do we welcome refugees, do we welcome immigrants? This is a country of immigrants. The first people who came here, and again, we have to remember that there were people living here called the Native Americans, who were not treated very appropriately. But when the first people came here, they were fleeing religious persecution. 20,000 Puritans who were persecuted in England came here seeking refuge in the many, many generations. And despite that, there's been persecution over the centuries of Irish, of German, certainly Jews fleeing the Holocaust. The borders were closed. And there's a famous ship called the St. Louis, which was successful in leaving Germany, but when it came to these shores, it was turned back with full knowledge of what would happen to many of those people. So as a country, we own that, and certainly as members of the Jewish community who have experienced this, the support that we have and give to refugees in this country, and the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which has been around for many, many years, helping Hebrew Jews come here, starting at the turn of the 20th century, is now very involved in Syrian refugees. And our Jewish Family Children's, our Jewish Vocational Service and Family Children's Service is just awaiting any refugee from Syria to welcome them to, or from Iraq, to welcome them and embrace them. Because, again, every year at Passover, we tell that story of being strangers, and it would be very hypocritical of us to remember that and then not to advocate for those people who today are strangers being able to come to the shores and take care of them.
You've been listening to a panel discussion entitled Violence, Fear, and the Refugee Crisis, Faithful Insights. An interfaith panel discussion recorded at Rockhurst University on March 31st. The panel included, in order, Reverend Dr. Anton Jacobs, a retired UCC pastor, author, and Christian Protestant faith director on the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council. Zohra Husseini, a devout Muslim and a nurse practitioner whose family emigrated from Afghanistan in the early 1980s. Baswati Ray, Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council, at-large director of the Hinduism Faith, and Alan Edelman, associate executive director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Kansas City and Jewish Faith Director on the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council. The panel was moderated by Ira Harrett of the American Friends Service Committee and was sponsored by the AFSC as well as the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council and Rockhurst University Voices for Justice. For more information, you can contact Ira at 816-931-5256 or AFSCKC at afsc.org. Now here's Ira on a similar event scheduled for May 19th.
Well, the American Friends Service Committee's next program addressing the topics of Syrian refugee crisis and responding to extremist violence will be on May 19th. That's a Thursday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. The program is entitled Confronting Extremist Violence, the Refugee Crisis and Fear, Faith Responses. And this will be taking place at the Kansas City, Missouri Plaza Branch at 4801 Main Street. We're really excited to have a great panel, including Dr. Vernon Howard, who's the president of the SCLC of Greater Kansas City, Fadi Banamare, a Syrian-born and a board member of the Islamic Society of Greater Kansas City, and Rabbi Linda Steigman, who's on the board of the Rabbinical Association of Greater Kansas City, and Father Paul Turner, who is pastor of St. Anthony Parish and is Roman Catholic Bishop Johnston's ecumenical representative. In addition to these great speakers, we'll also have, preceding the panel, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Steed, who teaches at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, to provide a strategic context for the program. And it will be moderated by Bill Timaeus, who's a retired KC Star columnist and the author of Faith Matters blog. That's all at the Kansas City Public Library on May 19th, Thursday at 6:30 to 8, and preceded by a reception. And we encourage people to RSVP on the library website. We hope this next event on May 19th will help our community recognize that we will not improve our security at home nor defeat extremism abroad by fear-driven Islamophobia, xenophobia, and vengeful military actions. Instead, hope for the future will come through the rejection of fear and looking to the core values taught by all faiths: compassion, love, respect, and truth. Security and peace and the defeat of extremism will come not from weapons and bombs, but from actions that win the hearts and minds of the world.